rather shorter than me. Right. First of all, thank you all for coming, and a special thanks to our speakers, Rick and Tracy and Maureen and Jimmy. This is a really special event because even those of us that are politicians or social organizers or performers, this is really different because this isn't about a cause or you have no script, and the topic is yourself, which can be a little nerve-wracking to actually share about yourself. And I'd also like to thank Jesse for sharing this wonderful space with us.
Yeah.
So we're here today to talk on the topic, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Why did I choose this? I chose it because it's universal. Because every decision we make, every choice we make because we think it's a good idea at the time. I mean, does anybody say, there's absolutely no way this could work and it's going to be horrible? Let's do it. I mean, sometimes it's very, very slim that it'll work out. There's almost no chance, but sometimes that tiny sliver of maybe, just maybe, this will be great. You could do it anyway. Things can seem like a good idea, and sometimes the decisions are really huge, and they make history. Maybe some people wake up in the morning and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to start a huge social revolution that solves racial injustice or fixes healthcare or poverty. And some of us wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and think, I'm going to give myself bangs. Do you ever look back on the course of history and wonder, what were people actually thinking? We can read later in hindsight about all these great and not so great people. But we all know hindsight is 20/20, and we also know none of us are 100% on our decisions every time. Like Susan B. Anthony, did she ever like a quiet moment sitting alone, and she's like, all of this fighting for justice is really hard. Like, maybe I'll just start a commune somewhere and let future generations figure this out, because I'm just tired. Or Martin Luther King, when he was being hauled off to Birmingham jail, did he be like, should I stay home with a good book? But there was a chance, and it was a good idea, and they went off into the wild blue, and it was worth it. Conversely, I've given myself bangs 3 times now, and I assure you, it is never a good idea. It never was, and it never will be. But I'm really glad we're doing this, because we're living in historical times right now, and we'll be the characters in those history books. And whatever decisions we make, it'll be based on who we are as individuals and how we treat each other. So I'm glad we're all here, because this shows we're really interested in getting to know each other. We're listening. Because as brave as it is to come up here and speak, it's just as brave to listen. So I'm done rambling now. I'm going to ramble more throughout the night, so I'm getting comfortable. So first, I would like to introduce Rick Hoyt. I met him in Geneva, and I've been lucky enough to attend his wonderful music parties at his wonderful house with his wonderful wife. You probably know him as a musician from the Cool Club. He also plays with the Lipker Sisters. Some of them are here. They're awesome, too. Go see them. So Rick Hoyt, would you like to come to the stage and tell us a story?
Okay. Hopefully help me out with the guitar level, if it's too loud or not loud enough. But I'm not used to being in a situation like this without a guitar, so Sarah said I could bring it, which is good. It's like my support instrument. Anyway, I was really kind of surprised and gratified to get asked to do this. Not something that happens every day. So I was thinking about the theme of, what is the theme? Oh yeah, seemed like a good idea to decide. I mean, that brings to my mind, unintended consequences and irony. And of course, the sense of irony is pretty essential, I think, to survive with. But anyway, I was thinking about the stories that came to my mind that I would want to tell that brought up with that. And as I was thinking about them, I thought about You know, I'm here, you know, my stories are the stories really of a pretty sheltered and privileged baby boomer, not only white, straight, male, all that stuff. And so they're not going to be about overcoming huge adversities. You know, I mean, it's not like my life has been perfect, but there's a lot of people who've had a lot of harder time going through the times I've been through than I have. And so before I start, I just want to acknowledge those folks and their stories. And I don't mean mine to cast any kind of disrespect in any way. Again, he's gotten himself in a great big jam way down yonder in Vietnam. So drop your books, pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, don't give in. Next stop is Vietnam. And 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. And there ain't no need to wonder why. Well, we're all gonna die. So that's a song by Country Joe McDonald, and it looks like some of you have heard that. You may or may not be grateful that I left out the cheer that anyway. So, you know, my story is not about Vietnam, but about my career as a Vietnam War protester. So I would like to say that my opposition to the military and joining it was based on strongly held moral principles. The truth of the matter is the main reason, as I was sure the uniforms are going to be really uncomfortable. I had kind of a thing with fabrics when I was a kid, and I mean, getting dressed up to go to church was torture enough. And so I looked at like those pictures of the guys in like the dress uniforms, and, you know, I would not last. So anyway, and also, you know, sort of being anti-war and going to protests and stuff was kind of a way to be cool for in my day. So I, you know, participated in that, and I did as they say. I tuned in and I dropped out and went to Europe. I burned the draft card. I was, you know, a free spirit in the world for about 4 months until I ran out of money. Came back to the U.S. and then the draft was going on, and what they had was a lottery at the time, and they came out with, and based on your birthday, they would assign you a score, and the lower your score, the more likely you were to be drafted. And I came out with a four. I had a 273. You know, I thought I was home free, but nonetheless, I got a letter from the Selective Service saying I needed to go report for examination or something. So immediately, I ain't no fool, I went to school, got back into college. So this was in the spring of 1970, and that time President Nixon and Henry Kissinger decided invading Cambodia would be a good idea. And so there were protests all across the country. Some of them were pretty tragic. Kent State, Jackson State, you know, people got shot. I was at Syracuse University. And, you know, we struck. We took over the campus. You know, we built barricades at the entrances. We had bonfires. We sat around and sang Woodstock and waited for the National Guard to arrive, but they never did, actually. Syracuse University decided at that point what they did when they made a deal, and they said, okay, at this point in the semester, you can take whatever grade you have, and that'll be your grade for the whole semester. So I went around, you know, in the one course I wasn't doing so good in, I got a pass fail, so when it all added up, I was on the dean's list. And my father had a standing deal with all his kids. If you got on the dean's list in college, he would buy you a car. Oh. So I got a car, a used Chevy Nova. And I also fell in love, you know, so all in all, you know, that worked out for me. I mean, not so good for Cambodia, I'd say, which is not really funny. But that is my career as a war protester. But, you know, the point I guess I want to make, the sort of the seemed like a good idea at a time and the unintended consequences. Now, I think about
is this was like all anti-government protesting we were doing. This was the left. You know, and the irony to me is these days, the anti-government protesters are on the right. You know, the sort of, you know, scariest words are, we're from the government, we're here to help you. You know, it's government regulation, it's a bad thing. It's kind of funny how things work out sometimes. Well, that's the first story, and hopefully I will have enough time for my stories. Give me a notice if I'm running out of time. Mr. Thompson calls a waiter, orders steak and baked potato, but he never eats the gristle, and he always leaves the skins. And a busboy comes and takes it, with a cough contaminates it, and he throws it in a can with coffee grounds and sardine tins. And a truck comes by on Friday and hauls it all away, and 1,000 more just like it are converging on the bay with garbage. We're filling up the seas with garbage. What will we do when there's nowhere left to put all garbage? So that's a song by Pete Seeger. And you don't need somebody to come to Seneca Falls and talk to you about garbage. But, you know, I think about that, and I think, you know, about just all the threats to the environment, you know, not just carbon dioxide, but all the stuff that gets tossed in. And I think about, I mean, even public sanitation. And I was sort of because it seems to me it's all kind of the same kind of story, is like, and some of the struggles that took place before even cities started the idea of having public sanitation. And even today, I mean, New York City, many other major cities, they have combined stormwater and sewage. So whenever there's a lot of rain, the sewage just doesn't get treated. It goes straight into the bay. Many people around the world, even in the U.S., have no access to bathrooms. It's pretty hard to find a public restroom these days. So, you know, we're trying to think about how can we address climate change. We can't even deal with our own, you know what word I want to use. So my old little story I want to say, I'll fast forward from the days of anti-war protester, wannabe hippie, to when all of us were having babies and we had jobs. But, you know, we still wanted to save the world, and one thing that came up was recycling. As some of you may not realize it, recycling didn't always happen. You know, that all that stuff just, you know, went into the garbage. Myself and some of our friends, we were living up in Lyons at the time. We sat out in the rain in front of Santelli's Lumber on Saturday mornings. We asked people to bring us your cans and your plastic and stuff. And then there was a recycling place up in Macedon. We all hauled it off to. So yeah, that was kind of part of it. And we could sort of say, wow, maybe that did have kind of an outcome, because now recycling is everywhere. But I mean, the irony to me there is 8% of what gets put in recycling actually gets recycled. And so the argument could be, okay, what we really do is we just create, again, the scam. It's okay to have all this disposable stuff because it gets recycled. Well, it doesn't really get recycled. So I'm going to put in a plug for Marilla and the Waste Not Shop. Yeah. Because stuff gets reused.
That's there. Plastic-free goodies.
If you haven't been to the Waste Not Shop, and there's a song there, but I'm not going to play it tonight because I did get my beat. You know. So anyway, that gets me to the third story here, and last one before I get out of the way. So I'm going to flash backwards now to the very early to mid-1960s, and I was a geeky young guy. I was playing with my toy soldiers. And the Beatles came on the radio and transformed my existence to this day, you know. And it's been a lot of fun playing music, but, you know, sometimes I think about what it really was, in a way, was a really effective marketing scheme. to sell musical merchandise to like young suburban white boys. And it worked really well. And we bought the records, we bought the guitars, the musical instruments. We bought into, you know, wanting to be a Beatle. And that thought it was cool, but you know, sometimes I think, boy, what a fantastic manipulation that was. But, you know, as a result of that, you know, marketing scheme, he got me here playing the guitar. And I composed a song here titled It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time. And I'm going to try to get the chorus across to you so you can maybe sing along if you like. So it goes, it seemed like a good idea at the time. The full effects may not be known till many years go by. Full effects may not be known till many years gone by. You just kick the can on down the road. Just kick the can on down the road. Hoping that the trail goes cold. Trail grows cold is kind of a tongue twister, but just hoping that the trail grows cold. And you never have to pay for the crime. It seemed like a good idea at the time. You'll catch on by the end. Business is booming. Our efforts have been graced. There's just one problem. It generates a whole lot of waste. Ain't gonna let a thing like that interfere with living the dream. The water is wide, we'll pump it into the stream. Here we go. Seemed like a good idea at the time. The full effects may not be known to many years gone by. Kick the can, you just kick the can on down the road. Open that trail grows cold and you never have to pay for the crimes. Oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Consideration for others and the future is not the easy way. Especially when it ain't that clear how you get through today. What is there to keep us from indulging in excess? Especially when it's someone else gets to clean up the mess. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. Full effects may not be known till many years gone by. You just kick the can on down the road. Hoping that the trail grows cold and you never have to pay for your crimes. Oh, it seemed like a good idea. What are we thinking? If we'd open up our eyes, we might see how we are engineering our own demise. When future generations ask, how could you let it get this way? Will this be the only thing we have got to say? Oh, it seemed like a good idea. Full effects may not be known till many years gone by. You just kick the can on down the road. Open that trail grows cold and you never have to pay for your crimes. Oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Thank you.
Anyone who didn't fill out a slip or didn't get one, Jesse in the back will give you one. This is just a little audience participation, and I thought I'd ask a few of you what you might have done that seemed like a good idea at the time. Okay, have you ever done something drastic that seems like a good idea at the time, and how did it turn out? I left my husband and home behind. Worked out well.
I
exhausting, but best dog ever. This one's just, yes, got named. Okay. That. Okay. Next, I'd like to welcome a woman we've all probably heard of from her congressional campaign from the 23rd District. You've probably seen her signs in everybody's front yard. Or you may know her from her work at Cornell University or the fact that she was born and bred in upstate New York and probably know her from just shoveling snow. I'm really excited she chose to share with us on a more personal level because it must be even harder when you're under a political microscope. But if there's one thing I admire about Tracy, it's because she's fearless and she has this ability to forge a new path through the status quo. So I'm really excited to hear her story and get to know her. So Tracy McConnell, everyone.
Good evening, everyone, and it's so nice to see old friends and new friends. So many stories have been coming to mind. I did just get a dog recently from this wonderful person here, Jean, who got me a duck toller. And I was at the dentist the other day, and I was talking about my children, who also used to go to that practice, but of course since moved on to big, exciting places like Washington and Boston. And then I said something about my partner, and it's kind of a conservative place. My partner is a woman. I said, so let me show you the love of my life. And I can see they're kind of like holding on, you know, preparing to get the right response and so forth. And I showed them Teddy the duck toller, and they were delighted. Oh, my gosh. Well, there was a picnic in July of 2017, at which I believe I met you for the first time. And someone said, why don't you get up on that park bench and make a speech? It seemed like a good idea. And the aforementioned partner, who had thought that I was completely loopy in talking about leaving a job that pays more than Congress to run for Congress, and I got in the car and she said, I think you have to do it. But that's not my story. So a couple of weeks ago, I thought of going out to the scope groups, which I have been here in Seneca and I do in all of the counties, the 11 counties in this district. And scope is the New York State version of the NRA. Would be a good idea at the time in Cattaraugus County. And we have done a study of this entire district, and there is no more absolutely solidly red part of this district than the northern part of Cattaraugus County. And so I go out there, and I'll spare you a lot of the variation on a theme. But it seemed, as I say, like a good idea at the time, until the man who invited me, and I'd been already talking for about 20 minutes or so, we got on the issue of immigration, and he slammed his hand on the desk, and he said, my family came through Rikers Island, and everyone else can come through Rikers Island, too. I said, no, anyone who watches Law and Order. But as I really cast over my thoughts to share tonight, I remembered my friend Susan Necklace in college. And Susan was really something special, and she remains so to this day. She's a big-time, white-collar defense attorney with a big office on Madison Avenue in New York and so forth. But I met her when I was a student at the University of Rochester, and she really is special. I mean, I just tell you a little tangent to give the flavor. She wanted to go to law school, and she was the year ahead of me. And I don't know what they do nowadays, but then you had to go and sit for the LSAT exam, and there were only three or four of them a year. So So if you missed one, you might have missed the entire opportunity to start the following year. Well, she missed the one, I guess, in September. And maybe there was another one in December or something like that, because she slept through the one that she was supposed to go to. And I probably shouldn't have used her name, so don't say anything. But, you know, we were all on her side and supportive as December is nearing and saying, you know, what can we do to help you, Susan, and so forth. She said, don't worry, I'll take care of it myself. She went out, she found this professor that she liked, who was 40 years her senior, slept with him that night, walked into the LSAT exam, and in those years, it was 800 was the top. She got a 780.
Oh, wow.
She went to Yale. And then fast forward to her second year, and she's interviewing in a big white shoe law firm. That means like the elite of the elite. She's half Puerto Rican and half whatever, Scottish or something. And as the partner's walking her to the door of the office, he's trying to figure out whether she's an affirmative action candidate or not. And this is so Susan. And then I'll get to the story about And she gets to the door, and of course he's being very sporty and puts out his hand and says, oh, it's so good to meet you. And by the way, what did you get on the LSAT? And this is just so silly, she said, fuck you, and walked out the door. Because she got 780. I mean, she was the real thing. So Susan was really a force of nature. And she kept telling me in college that she wanted to get a tattoo. And I kept saying to her, Susan, you don't want a tattoo. This is in the year of our Lord, by the way, 1980. So it's before you, I mean, even just where you had go to get a tattoo was a little bit of an adventure. But she focused on me because I grew up in Rochester, where we were going to school. My father had a restaurant downtown, so I knew where those tattoo parlors were. And I had a car. So she kept working on me. You know, Tracy, come on, take me for a tattoo, take me for a tattoo. And I kept trying to counsel her out of it until one night. We were out partying as undergraduates do. Early in the evening, she had thrown a beer at the guitar player. For some, in her perception, allegedly sexist thing that he said, entirely possible. But at any rate, do you get the picture of Susan? Okay. So we go out, we're having fun, and at 2 o'clock in the morning when the bars close in Rochester, she says, come on, Tracy, we're going to do it. I said, all right, Susan, I will take you. And we show up at this old-fashioned tattoo parlor. And she said, you stay with me, so at least we have some, you know, reason operating. And I went back with her to the little area, and sure enough, she got this little heart right here. And I don't know whether it was the cocktails earlier, I don't know whether it was the influence of this amazing person, but I looked down at it, and I thought, you know, that's not such a bad idea. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. But I, too, in the year of our Lord, 1980, got a tattoo.
I did not expect a tattoo story from that.
I am very impressed. I thought I first was like 15. We borrowed my best friend's older sister's ID. It was like Shaq and Honeyway. I'm lucky I'm not dead. She was so mad, by the way. She's like, I'm never speaking to you again. Still my best friend. Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's read a few more of these. All right. I was in the Navy. I was in an area I wasn't supposed to be in. My buddy found a key in the forklift that had been left there by a civilian employee. He gave the code over the radio. I turned the lights off on my truck and
backed up to his location. We were having great fun until our supervisor came out to check on us. I needed to get out fast. However, I was not on the road I thought I was on. The road ended and my truck flew due to the hazard style, only I wasn't wearing Daisy Dukes. Needless to say, I was not on Captain's top 10 list.
Wendy.
Thanks, Matt.
I read my daughter's diary because she was acting so different and strange, and I thought maybe she was on drugs. Turned out she had an eating disorder. She lost all trust in me, but she got the help she needed. Alright, so next up we have a woman I also admire, but I don't know very well. I met her at the Women's March this year through a friend, and she is actually one of the organizers, which is pretty cool. She's also a wellness advisor for Young Living, and a performer, and a mother of a special needs child. I don't know her that well, so I'm particularly interested in hearing her story so I can know her better. So let's welcome Maureen Quigley.
Sarah, thanks everybody. Thanks for the stories. Now I'm thinking of all these things that I thought we were a good idea at the time. When I had an idea of what I was going to talk about tonight, and then I reached out to my sister and my two of my nieces that I'm very close with, and I said, you know, this is what I think of talking about. What do you think? And so my sister, who I'm very, very close with her, she's 10 years older than me, and she, can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm an actress, and she said, how about you tell, you know, the story of how mom wouldn't allow you to be in plays. And, you know, my mother just was really afraid of me being an actress. She was born and raised in England, and she knew a young girl who had gone off to be in theater, and she'd gotten pregnant. This is back, you know, during World War II time. She'd gotten pregnant, and there was scandal, and, you know, and my mother worried about me. So I kind of snuck into theater. You know, I said, well, can I do backstage work? And she let me do that, and lo and behold, somebody dropped out, and I got, you know, to be in the show. And so fast forward, I've, you know, done a lot of very gratifying stage work and some film work, and so what seemed like a good idea at the time really was for me. And I think when I approached this, I sort of thought, you know, when you think of it seemed like a good idea at the time, you kind of think of regret. But I always find, you know, in hindsight, something good about something that at first might have been regretful. One of my nieces suggested that because I love my son so desperately, and when he was an infant, we'd be out and we'd be eating, and I would just have a mouthful, and I'd say, "Hi, honey," you know, and I have my mouth just full of food. And she said, "Why don't you talk about, you know, how ridiculous you were with Hank when he was little?" And then my other niece said, "How about you talk about the fact that you wore parachute pants in the 90s?" I love those. But what I'm going to talk about is something that happened to me when I was a child. I was 9 going on 10, and I grew up way out in the country, 2 miles west of Skaneateles. My backyard looked like a cornfield, but it was just way out in the country. The youngest of 7 kids. We had moved from Skaneateles Falls when I was 2. And in Skaneateles Falls, there was a lot of kids, you know, but where we moved to, there really weren't. So I spent a lot of time alone. You know, a lot of family time, but play time was, and we didn't have a lot of money, so I spent a lot of time playing with frogs and sitting by streams and, you know, imagining there were people there. I think there really were. And so I was a really good tree climber. I was just really good at climbing trees. And we had this big old house, you know, big old farmhouse, and a maple tree on either side. as you looked out to the road. And the maple tree on the left was a really good climbing tree. It had just the right, you know, branch to put your leg over and just climb up. And I would climb, well, there were big trees way above the house. I would climb to the very tippy top of that tree and swing. You know, swing. I just loved it. I loved it. And we had our share of, you know, good Irish Catholic, you know, alcoholic dysfunction in the family. So there was a reason to get in the tree and just swing. It was just a huge joy of mine. I felt like I was flying. I really, really loved that. So the other tree was not a good climbing tree. So we had a swing. My dad and my oldest brother had made this rope swing. And it was a swinging tree. It was a great tree to swing. But I really wanted to climb that tree. And my older sister and two of my older brothers, you know, they thought that, you know, that might be fun. They didn't climb trees the way I did, but they thought it might be fun. So my oldest brother built a rope ladder for us to get into that tree. So one day, we climb it, and one day some family friends were coming over, and my sister Peggy and my brothers John and Chris and I thought it would be a good idea at the time to all climb into that tree, climb the rope ladder, climb in the tree, and hide. So I got myself into a good position in the tree. I was just so comfortable in trees, so comfortable. And my sister Peggy wasn't as comfortable, and she was struggling a little bit. And I said, "Well, just take my spot. I'll go up higher." And I went up higher, and I stepped on a branch, and the branch broke. And down I went. And there was a rule in my house, you don't scream. Because when you scream, that's an alarm. I remember someone screamed. I don't know if it was me. I think it was my sister. But I fell about 15 feet. And I ended up at what was then Auburn Memorial Hospital with a head concussion and a fractured skull. In the hospital for a week. And back then, you didn't go to the hospital. You know, we didn't, you know, Dr. Horn from Skinny Alice would come over with his black bag, you know, to the house. It was very rare that, you know, it was bad enough that you went to the hospital. So I was in the hospital for a week. There was no CAT scans, MRIs. The doctor would just come in and he had me stand up and he would just check my balance, and I would sleep on ice cubes. I had like a big Flintstone cartoon egg on the back of my head, and I called it my pin cushion. You know, my head was cracked here, so you could kind of push it in. And and I remember it so clearly. Waking up, you know, coming to or whatever in slow motion at the base of the tree and seeing my dad, you know, just running down the front steps and coming and getting me, picking me up and carrying me into the house, and my mother, and with seven kids, when that much focus was on you, it was, you know, it was serious. And my sister, Terry, her boyfriend at the time was a EMT, and he looked at me and he said, you got to get her to the hospital. And I remember riding in the station wagon on my mom's lap, and I don't remember being scared, but I knew she was scared. And she worked in Auburn. She was a legal secretary, and she'd come in to visit me in the morning before she went to work. And I remember it was so hard, to see her go, and I cry. But I had a great, and she'd come in after work, you know, but she had to get home. There was a lot going on at home. But my roommate was Susan Pritchard, and she had a broken leg. And so she couldn't get out of bed. Someone had brought us chocolate, and it was across the room. And I was not supposed to get out of bed, but I could. So I did. And I'd get us the chocolate, and I'd pass it around. And I remember it was 1968, and that was, during that week was when Bobby Kennedy was killed, and you know, back then you didn't have the cable news stations. You had, you know, 3, 5, and 9 and PBS or, you know. But at the hospital, they had more than that. And there was this one station that all it showed, I'll never forget, it was so imprinted on me, all day long was a picture of Bobby Kennedy. And then when I went home, I was so tenderly cared for in a pretty raucous house, you know, with brothers and, you know, hunting and just a lot of stuff going on. But I was, when I look back on it, I knew I was loved, but I just remember my mom washing my hair, so afraid my head would hit the faucet, you know, just washing me so tenderly. And it was spring, and I spent a lot of time on the big old front porch, and I would sleep out there during the day while my brothers and sisters were at school. And they'd come home, you know, and they were the ones teasing the little Maureen. You know, I was always a pain in everybody's butt. But they were so careful with me. And so I look back at that time, and I feel love. I feel a lot of love. And one thing, when Jimmy was talking about spirituality and God and something that I will never forget is that when I was falling, I felt, and I was just a kid, I felt a hand take my hair and push my head against the branch that held the swing. And that broke my fall. And I slid down the rest of the tree. My back was all scratched. And I often think about that. I think when I'm going through a hard time, and I think about that, and I think God wasn't done with me. There's something I needed to do, a reason for me to still be around. And when my faith wanes, and I'm a faithful person, but when it wanes, and I think, what the heck is the use of all of this? And, you know, all that's going on in the world, and we all get scared. I remember that. And it just strengthens me. And it's one of the things that I think of that keeps me moving forward one day at a time. So thank you.
Because everybody took it a different way. Because it always goes anyway when you make a decision. I mean, I've made some really bad decisions in my life because it seemed like a good idea at the time. Like, this one time, I got off this really great job in Miami. I got a lot of money, a condo on the beach, you know. I was living in Brooklyn and I was cold and in terrible relationships. I'm like, okay. And I went, and it's like a no-brainer. That's a good idea, right? I hate sunshine, and I hate the beach, and I don't care what you say, like, palm trees are not a tree, that is nothing, there's no branches, I made it a year, and I'm just like, no, this is not a good idea, but at other times, you know, you accept a blind date, and they show up 4 hours late, but you go to lunch with them anyway, because it seems like a good idea. And then it ends up being somebody you're willing to wait for the rest of your life. So thank you all for coming, and thank you for listening. Oh, you may go now.